Every day at 5 a.m., I will get up and I will run. And every day I'm tired and I'm cold. My legs hurt from running 6 miles the day before, and the pain will only double after today. People will always question why I do it, because from where they're standing, all they see is a struggle. I heard a saying once that from the bottom of a valley, as you're looking up at a mountain, you can't imagine ever seeing anything more brilliant and perfect. But once you're on the mountain, looking out over the infinite valley below, you can't imagine how you once thought something in this world could be more beautiful than this. I guess it all depends on where you're standing. And from where I'm standing, I see so much more than physical challenge. I see beyond the cold and the pain and the sweat and the tears. I don't see the obstacles like most people do. I see the endless possibility of a new day, an opportunity to make the most of my short time here on this earth. But I can only see this because of where I'm standing. It all depends on your point of view.
It really does depend on your point of view. Whether from where you're standing you see yourself in the midst of a divine drama that's playing out with your life as part of it, or whether you see yourself in the drudgery of random circumstances and just things that are coming at you that you have to deal with, that differentiation, your point of view, will make the difference on both your outlook and your response to your life circumstances. Point of view makes all the difference in the world. An elderly man was in the hospital, and next to him was his wife of 55 years. And as he became a little bit more lucid, he leaned over and looked toward her and said, "Is that you, Ethel, at my side again?" And she says, "Yes, I'm here." He said, "Oh, Ethel, you've been with me. When I came back from the war, I was in the VA hospital, and you were at my side then. When our house burned down and everything burned up, you were there with me. When we were poor in the very beginning and had nothing, you stood by my side." He said, "Ethel, I just want you to know, you are really bad luck." See, it all depends on your point of view. You could see this woman as a treasure that is there with you through thick and thin. Or you could see this woman as the jinx who's been ruining your life. Same person, same circumstances, different point of view. I want to welcome you to Hill Country Bible Church, and glad you're here to worship with us and to celebrate, to sing, and to praise God and to learn from His Word. And we also want to say welcome to all of our campuses and all the people that are watching online. Just excited to have you as part of that as well. If you're a visitor, we're glad you're here. And we trust that God is going to use this experience to deepen your understanding of your life and about His part and role in it. We're in the book of Esther. And so if you have a Bible, open to the Old Testament book of Esther. We're in chapter 2. Last week we looked at chapter 1, and in the midst of chapter 1 we met a king, King Xerxes, the king of history that fought against the Greeks and lost. Some of you guys had watched The 300, and that's a little bit about the same time. We meet in the first chapter, Xerxes is the most powerful man on the planet, and we ask the question, who's in charge of the world? I mean, it appears that with his wealth and his power, his money, his resources, his empire, that he's really in charge. But we also had to ask the question, can one person actually make a difference? Can one person change the world? Because his queen Vashti, when summoned, said no. And when she said no, it so bruised his ego and so wounded the king that he allowed his little inner circle to make a law that went throughout all the land that women would now start to respect their husbands, and men would be the head of the household. So you have to ask yourself the question, like, how can one person in the face of all this power make a difference? And we began to unpack the fact that many of us feel prisoner to our own circumstances, feeling like the powers that be run the world, and we're stuck. But a little deeper look, and you might begin to understand that those powers are shaky. And we begin to ask the question, can one person actually make a difference? And we begin to understand that one person actually can make a difference. Now, since tomorrow is Martin Luther King Jr. Day, I thought it would be appropriate to remind us again of one person making a difference. Now, as we unpack this, I just want you to think about point of view, okay? So when somebody on a given day runs into a given circumstance, is that circumstance significant or is it random? The person I have in mind is Rosa Parks. 1955, she decided that she was tired on that particular day of giving up her seat on the public bus. And when a white man got on the bus and expected her to move, she refused. Reflecting back on that moment in her book, Quiet Strength, here's what she says. She says, when I sat down on the bus that day, I had no idea history was being made. I was only thinking of getting home. But I had made up my mind after so many years of being a victim of the mistreatment my people suffered, not giving up my seat. And whatever I had to face afterwards was not important. I did not feel any fear sitting there. I felt the Lord would give me the strength to endure whatever I had to face. It was time for someone to stand up or, in my case, sit down. So I refused to move. Now, one day, on a public bus, a black woman sat down and said, enough is enough on this day. She had no idea what was going to happen. Probably in the moment that they arrested her, fined her, she may have been thinking at that moment, that was not a good idea. Look at the hassle, look at the pain, look at the problems. But what she did when she stayed in her seat was set in motion a protest that actually was the catalyst to change the segregation laws in the United States. By someone in a circumstance taking a stand, everything changed for a massive number of people. Now, that's not the only part of the story. In fact, I would encourage you guys to all go see the movie Selma. And you may or may not agree with the depiction of what takes place there, but I think it's worth watching. Cindy and I went a week ago expecting the theater to be packed. It really wasn't, which is kind of a statement about how we think in the U.S. Past history is past history. But the capability that we have when we're in a position of power to take advantage of people, whether they are of a different race, a different religion, a different socioeconomic group, a different age group, is deeply embedded in the human heart. And to be reminded about the struggle of the African American to find a place in this society after years of abuse is a very important thing for both African Americans and Anglos and Hispanics and Asians to get their minds around. So I would encourage you to do that. Can one person make a difference? You be the judge of that. So today, as we come to chapter 2, we meet Esther and Mordecai. And the question we ask in this chapter that the author is kind of bringing up for us to wrestle with is this question of, is life random? Is this a random story? Is circumstance just random in the world and I'm just kind of a prisoner of the randomness of my life? Or is there something going on where a sovereign God is designing and leading me through the circumstances of my life where every day, actually every experience is important and plays out in some important way? Now, keep in mind the book of Esther is unique among biblical books. It's a book where the name of God is not mentioned. It's not mentioned at all. In fact, there's no visions, there's no voices from heaven, there are no visible miracles that occur in the book. In fact, the people in the story, which we're going to see in this chapter, are not even following the Old Testament law, so they're not even doing the kinds of things that would be honoring to God. And yet, the result of this story is the salvation of a promise of all Jewish people that is still celebrated around the world today in the Festival of Purim. It's coming up in March. according to the promise of God that he would deliver his people. So you be the judge, random or divinely inspired. So let's dive in here. Starting in chapter 2, verse 1, we're really asking and answering the question here that rises to the occasion. Esther's rise to royalty. How does that come about? How does that come about? Is it random or is it divine? Watch what happens. Later. Okay. Let me just stop right there with that one word. This is actually 4 years after chapter 1. What happened in those 4 years is Xerxes pulled his army together. They went to fight the Greeks, and needless to say, they lost. So here's the king 4 years later, comes back from his conquest, humiliated, having lost face, and also lost a lot of his wealth. He's still the most powerful ruler on the planet, but really significantly diminished. And he turns from conquest of the empire to conquest in another way. Watch what happens. It says, later when the anger of King Xerxes subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. So he's got no wife. He's got no bride. He's lonely. Then the king's personal attendants proposed, let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful girls into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Haggai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the girl who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti. This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. Now, what we see taking place here is, again, another example of the king has a need. His advisors meet that need by putting everybody in the empire under some kind of rule or something happening. First, his need for glory and his need for prestige and recognition got rid of Vashti and put the decree out that men would rule their households. That was chapter 1. Now a decree, because he's lonely and he's looking for love, a decree goes out that every beautiful woman in all 127 provinces of the empire, this stretches all the way from Egypt and Sudan to Pakistan and India, gather up those women and bring them into the harem, and I'm going to choose one out of them to be my wife. Now, some of you would say, well, this story is totally sexist. I mean, everything about this story is totally sexist. And I would agree with that. But sexually, it's not discriminating between men and women. So what's important for us to understand here is not only did he have a sizable harem, but Herodotus tells us that every year he had 500 young men castrated to serve in his kingdom, because he didn't want anybody around him who could procreate and therefore think that they could seize the crown and the throne. And so he is indiscriminately destroying the ability to procreate, and what he's doing to the women. This is happening universally. Here's what we fail to understand. In our world, we have such a safe concept of the human body, that our body belongs to us, that nobody should have the opportunity to violate that, man or woman. And we are the master of our own soul, our own body, our own destiny. And what we don't understand is the world itself was not like that, and in many places still isn't. It was Christianity that brought the value of the individual and the sanctity of an individual human first to the Roman Empire, then to Europe, to the Americas. It's actually Christianity that laid the groundwork for this idea that people in power can't abuse other people. And so people sit here today, Christian and non-Christian, and enjoy an incredible, beautiful benefit because Christianity brought that value that God created people in his image, that he loves them, that Jesus died for them, that God wants a relationship with us, which gives everybody value. That's a Christian idea. And so there, it didn't matter to them. People were people. Slaves were slaves. Women were women. Men were men. You used them however you wanted to. Now we meet the characters in the story in verse 5. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiachin, king of Judah. So Mordecai is from the family of Benjamin. His grandfather is named Kish, who is also the same name of the father of the first king of Israel, King Saul. Now, I'll just throw that out there. It just happens to be a coincidence that we'll find out more about in the next chapter. Okay, so we'll put that out there for you. It said Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. She's an orphan. This girl, who was also known as Esther, was lovely in form and features. Drop dead gorgeous is what the original Hebrew means. In the midst of the world that we're talking about here, is that a blessing or is it not a blessing? You be the judge of that. The author doesn't tell us. Watch what happens. And Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her mother and father died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther was also taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Haggai, who had charge of the harem. The girl pleased him and won his favor. So 127 provinces, there had to be 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 or 7 or 10 good-looking women in each of those provinces. So you start stacking up the odds of how many girls are there, and one of them catches the eye of the eunuch, Haggai, who's over it, and she wins his favor. What are the odds of that? Is this random? Immediately he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 maids selected from the king's palace and moved her and her maids into the best place in the harem. Coincidence? Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. So he's very intently interested in what's going on with her. And he's telling her now, don't reveal that you are a Jew. Now Mordecai and Esther, both those names are Babylonian names. They both have a reference to a Babylonian god. So they have taken Babylonian names, and the fact that he's telling her, don't reveal that you're a Jew, means he's telling her, don't eat kosher. In other words, eat whatever you need to eat. So in contrast to Daniel, who when he's taken captive refuses to fit into the culture and keeps the Old Testament law, Esther and Mordecai are not doing that. They're not keeping the law. In fact, she's part of the harem now, which means she's going to be with a uncircumcised Gentile. That also means that she's going to be with a man that she's not married to. Like, you just line them up, all the Old Testament laws that they're not keeping by being part of this. Now, we can talk about whether she was taken against her will. We were talking about whether she was forced into doing this. We don't know whether if she would have revealed that she was a Jew, whether they would have executed her. It seemed like they were comfortable bringing everybody in, or whether they're just going along to get along, and in a tough place, they're willing to compromise. The author doesn't tell us that. Doesn't tell us that. It just feels very, very random what's taking place here. Let's keep going. Now watch this, verse 12. Before a girl's turn came to go into King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women. Like, this is a 12-month spa treatment on steroids. 6 months with oil of myrrh, and 6 months with perfumes and cosmetics. So they want her skin to smell perfectly. They want her to look perfectly. They want everything about her to be perfectly sensual. And that's what takes place for 12 months. She's got to get ready to be perfectly beautiful, to be worthy of spending the night with the king. Goes on to say, in the evening, she would go there Oh, excuse me, I skipped this part. Verse 13, and this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. I mean, that could be something from her homeland. It could be some kind of adornment, costume, jewelry. It could be some kind of aphrodisiac. We don't know what it is, but she had the opportunity to go in and take anything she wanted to try to impress the king so that she might get picked. In the evening, she would go in there, and in the morning, return to another part of the harem to the care of Shaashgaz, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. So let me try to fill it all in here. She's in the harem with the virgins. They are getting ready to spend a night with the king. She goes into the king that night, and when she exits, she doesn't go back with the virgins. She goes into the concubines. The concubines were all the women who had spent one night with the king, and because they had slept with the king, they were not available for anybody else. Unless they were called by name, and keep in mind, at least in this beauty contest part of this, he's seeing another woman every single night. The chance of someone being recognized out of all of those people and brought back was very small. So most of these girls would be prepared to have one night with the king, and then they would live in isolated desolation for the remainder of their days. Now, it would be in the palace, so they'd eat good food and they'd be in a good environment. But they never saw the king again. They were isolated from everybody else so that they could never fall in love, they could never get married, they could never have a family, they could never use their gifts or their talents or their ingenuity. Their life essentially from that point forward was over. Their one night with the king ended normal life for them. It ended normal life. And so the stakes are very high for a person who actually wants to have the king and have his kids and live in royalty, because only one gets it. Now, as weird as all this sounds, we have weird things like that in our world today too, you know. The Bachelor. Here's a farmer from Iowa, town of less than 500, who none of the women would be interested in if they met him in his overalls. You know, they just wouldn't. But since he's on The Bachelor, 30 women show up and they love him from the first moment they get on the set. And then they compete to see, first of all, if they can get the rose, secondly, if they can get the fantasy suite, and thirdly, can they get the ring and live happily ever after? Only knowing somebody that they've observed when cameras are watching them and producers are coaching them. Some of you are saying, you watch The Bachelor? So when I asked one of our staff members to do some research on what actually is happening and how all this thing works, she said to me, well, that would mean I would have to admit that I watch it. I said, yeah, but since I'm not, I need this information, okay? So no judgment here if you're watching that, but it's kind of weird, isn't it? That this kind of stuff plays out today. Romance, sexual intrigue, contest, trying to win the love of your life, a fantasy world where people use what they have to satisfy those people in power with the hope of getting something out of it. The more things change, the more they stay the same. So what happens in the story? In verse 15, when the turn came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. So she's not going to go in and try to impress him with something, whatever that something is. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. So everyone who came in contact with her, she is absolutely head and shoulders beautiful above the rest. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month the month of Tebeth, in the seventh year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. The king gave a great banquet. Now remember, it was the banquet where Vashti got dethroned. Now he's throwing a banquet, and it's Esther's banquet. For all his nobles and officials, he proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. So she wins. She gets the prize. She is now the queen with King Xerxes. She's spent the night with him. That's all she's done. So she's now the queen. Whatever we're going to find out that means coming up in the next couple chapters. Now, you be the judge. How is it that a Jewish orphan girl ends up in the citadel of Susa? She's got the looks to be invited into this contest, which involved probably 1,000 other women. Somehow, when she gets in there, the eunuch who's in charge of the women picks her out and says, wow, she's superior, gives her special favors. She comes into the king not bringing anything special, whatever that means. And not only does he remember her, but he falls in love with her, whatever that means, and she becomes a queen. Random? You be the judge of that. Random circumstances? Well, it doesn't end there. The other character in our story, verse 19, Mordecai, when the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, but Esther kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do, for she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. So they're still hiding their identities. During that time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Now, we've excavated this gate in the citadel of Susa. It's not simply a passageway through the wall. The gate was the place where taxes were collected, tariffs were paid, where contracts were signed, and there are two big, huge, huge halls that are built on each side of this gate where people who are coming in would stop off and do business. Maybe Mordecai was actually one of the scribes that was part of that. So he's there, and he's listening in, and watch what happens. It says, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were hanged on the gallows. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. Question here, this treasonous plot that's foiled, was he in the right place at the right time, or is this a divine appointment? Right place at the right time or a divine appointment? You be the judge. Right place. He's sitting at the gate. Right time. He happens to be there when these two men are making their plot. Right connection. Oh, my niece, who I've raised as my own, happens to just be the queen. Whoa. In addition to that, the information proved to be right. It was accurate. In other words, when they investigated the plot, they found out it was actually true, which led to the execution of these two men. The right credit is given. Mordecai's name is actually recorded in the record book, the annals that the king keeps, his daily journal, excuse me, or log of everything that takes place. Now, is this going to play a role in the story? You're going to have to come back to find out if this is going to play a role in the story. I kind of think it probably will. So you be the judge. Is all of this random? Is all of this random? If it feels random to you, the author intends for you to wrestle with, is this random? Because I think for most of us, that's a question we wrestle with in the day-to-day experience of our own personal life. The teacher that I got for math class that's way over my head, it's killing me. Was that random? The guy that I met at work that appears to be interested in me and started making you know, moves in my direction. That means he sent me a text message. Like, is that random? Is there something here? The fact that I found myself coming to Austin for one job, and then a short time later I'm in another job and I hate this job? Is that random? Is that random? The world around me, am I kind of a prisoner of circumstances that just come my way and keep coming my way? Or do those events actually mean something? If you believe that the events and circumstances of your life actually have something to do with God's bigger plan, it will change both your outlook and your response. Now, here's what's really important to understand. God is working in this story to save his people, in spite of the fact that his people in the story don't appear to be on page with him. Sometimes people get swept up in circumstances beyond their control. And in the midst of those circumstances, they choose to do the right thing. That would be Daniel. And God works in that. Other times, they choose to do the wrong thing. That would be Esther and Mordecai. And guess what? God works in that too. Because the hero of this story and the hero of your story and my story, it's not me. It's not you. It's God. Let me tell you why that's so important to understand. If you see God as the hero of your story, then you will begin to look for his hand in the circumstances of your life. If you view yourself as the hero of the story, when you're beat down, when you're pushed down, or when you've taken yourself down through bad decisions, you'll just simply say, I don't know, I'm here by chance, circumstances. God didn't have anything to do with this. God's not involved. I can't turn to him. I can't look to him. It's all about perspective. And what we've been challenging you in this series, coming from our theme verse, 2 Corinthians 4:18, where Paul says, we do not look at the things that are seen but unseen, because the things that are seen are temporary, the things that are unseen are eternal. And so we challenged ourselves to look long. When you have the circumstance in your life, don't just ask the question, what's happening in the moment? Ask yourself the question, what's happening in the day, in the week, in the month, in the year, in the 10 years, in my lifetime, in the life to come after that? In other words, how could what's playing out today actually be a building block for my future and for the future of others who will be impacted by this? Take a longer look. Don't get stuck simply looking at the moment and having to find everything in the moment. Look longer than that. God's playing out his hand. But the second thing we talked about is look deeper. Is there something going on in this moment and circumstance of your life that God is going to use? And is he changing you and opening you up and connecting you with others? What's he actually doing to teach you how to love him and trust him more? Here's the key. Many of us feel trapped. We make selfish decisions. And then that from that point forward, we think our past defines our future. And so therefore, since I can't do better than what I've done up to this point, I'm not going to try. I'm not going to try. And here's the message of the gospel. The gospel is this. When Jesus Christ died on the cross, he was dying on the cross to pay for all of the sins of the world. In other words, everything that someone has done that caused pain in your life, every time you've been pushed down, controlled, beaten up, he was suffering and literally enduring your pain. And then he was also paying for your sin. He was taking the punishment for all of your sin. In other words, what Jesus Christ did when he died on the cross, he redeemed your past so that you can walk with him in a new future. And Jesus Christ redeems not only what's been done to us, but what we have done to contribute to the problems in our lives and the problems in the world. God is going to save the nation of Israel. He's going to save Mordecai. He's going to save Esther. They're going to play a little role in this in coming chapters. But God will redeem even their flawed decisions in order to do something greater. My challenge to us is, wherever you are, what is the longer look? What's God doing? Where's this going? What's his plan here? Delve into the mystery of that. Look deeper. What is he trying to teach me? What's he showing me? How will this shape things in ways that I never would have thought? Vashti said no, and it changed the kingdom. Esther said yes, and it changes the kingdom. Rosa Parks said no, and it changes the whole United States. Look deeper. What's God calling you to in this moment? I'd like us to bow our heads. With heads bowed, I just want to give you a moment to reflect. Where are you right now? What's your perspective? Can you see Jesus? Or do you just see your circumstances? Victories, failures, confusion. Let your heart dive deeply into Jesus. Let your eyes be lifted for a longer look at what he's doing. Father, my prayer is for each of us that we would be overwhelmed by how deeply and personally you love us, and that out of that love and the forgiveness we have in your Son, we would have confidence to trust you fully.